This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Herman Schwartz is a professor in the Department of Politics at the University of Virginia, director of graduate studies. His most recent book is Subprime Nation. It is must reading if you want to get some grasp about how we got to where we are today. He joins me live in studio to talk a little bit about the politics of healthcare. It's good to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Coy.
So the politics of healthcare, I guess the first place to start is what you said when you sat down, when you came in here just a few minutes ago, and you said, it's about the money. It really has so much to do with the money involved in healthcare. What did you mean by that?
What I meant by that was that if you look at spending on healthcare, America, as compared to other rich countries, we spend more than twice as many dollars per capita for healthcare. We're spending around $5,100, $5,200 a year per person on healthcare. Other rich countries, on average, are spending around $2,100 on healthcare. What explains the difference? Well, the first place to start looking for the difference is that out of that $5,000 we're spending on healthcare, $5,200 on healthcare, about $1,000 is going to administration. And that's the cost of paying all the people in the private health insurers salaries to verify that you actually have insurance, to deny your claims when you thought you were covered, to find ever more clever ways of denying claims and throwing sick people out of the pool because insurance companies only make money off of healthy clients when they give out health insurance. So part of the difference and part of the important money here is that $1,000 per capita we're spending on administration. And the companies, the health insurance companies, of course, this is where their profits come from. It's where the salaries for the executives come from. If the government were to replace private health insurance with a public system, which was something that was on the table back before the election, all that money disappears out of their pockets. The health insurance companies don't make profits. The executives don't have jobs. And if I can personalize it a little bit, my cousin, who's a health insurance administrator, he loses his job too, although he's on the hospital side of it. So there's a lot of money at stake for a lot of people. And so these people lobbied ferociously against the healthcare bill. On the other side of the table, right, are the people who pay those costs. And those are a collection of big American corporations, the ones that still provide healthcare for their employees. They're a diminishing number. And then, of course, private individuals who are buying health insurance on their own. So the high cost of health insurance for them is a burden. American corporations that offer healthcare, and this would be your General Motors or your General Electric or your University of Virginia, they face ever higher costs for healthcare, and they have a huge incentive to find some way to hold those costs down. One way would be to strip out administrative costs. One way would be for the government to find some way to introduce actual competition into the health insurance market, where there's very little competition. One way would be to find ways to ration care in a politically acceptable way. So they have a huge interest also, and they're the other side of the equation in the healthcare fight. There wouldn't have been a healthcare fight if there wasn't a side that was paying for these high healthcare costs.
But we're rationing care now. That's an important point that I thought was missed in the big debate. You know, you had a lot of folks who were against any kind of reform and were saying, you know, don't ration my health care. It's being rationed now by private companies.
Yes, and it's also being rationed in two different ways. So first, you have about 45 or 50 million people who don't have health care at all, and health care is rationed for them. They don't have it. There is a misleading argument that, yes, they get health care. It's through the emergency room. But given that most of what people suffer from is chronic illnesses, emergency room care is worse than second best. It's something like 100th best. If you have asthma, if you have diabetes, if you have cancer, going to the emergency room is not going to help solve your problem. And it also, importantly, it's not going to help your problem get better and therefore reduce costs in the long run. So that's the first kind of rationing. And then the second kind of rationing is that even when you have health insurance, people face lifetime caps and people face the risks that a claim will be denied. So UVA, I'm an employee of UVA. UVA has great health insurance. UVA imposes a $2 million lifetime cost on healthcare. Hopefully, you never get there. It takes an expensive and complicated kind of problem to get you there. And the kinds of problems that get you there are things like bone marrow transplants, two or three of those. But even so, there is rationing that way. And of course, if you're in a, if you're buying health insurance as a private individual, you have the ever-present risk of being rationed out through rescission, which is when the health insurance company says, oh yes, you paid us all these premiums, but there's a technical problem with your application. I'm afraid your policy's been canceled. So people face rationing there as well. So it's a myth that there is no rationing in the system now. People who don't have health insurance are rationed out. People who have who do have health insurance often face rescission or restrictions on who they can see. So the question is, how can we have the maximum amount of health care for the same amount of dollars? And that's somewhat taken care of in the current bill, but not entirely.
We're talking with Herman Schwartz. His most recent book is Subprime Nation. He's a professor in the Department of Politics at the University of Virginia and director of graduate studies. The phone lines are open at 977-1070. We invite the listeners to join this conversation at any time. Your thoughts on the bill that was passed? It struck me that that President Obama, and I think some liberals would say this to a fault, is all about compromise. And because some of my liberal friends were very angry about the bill that was passed. It wasn't progressive enough. It didn't fix enough of the problems, and it left the, I guess they would say, it left the core of the problems intact and sort of, you know, worked around the edges a little bit. But what were your thoughts about the process and the results?
Well, the process was ugly. There's no doubt about that. And it was marked by a lot of out-and-out lies. I mean, not just misinformation, but lies. So that was definitely a bad thing. In terms of results, politics, is, as they always say, is about the art of the possible. It seems to me, given the makeup of the Senate, that what was possible was what they got. And what they got was not entirely bad. What they got was some hugely important things. Number one, no rescission. Rescission, again, means that you sign up and pay for health insurance, but then when you get sick, your policy is canceled because of technical errors in the application. That's a huge, hugely important thing. Another hugely important thing in the current bill is that people cannot be barred from getting insurance on the basis of pre-existing conditions. Right now, most of the people who have insurance in the U.S. who are under the age of 65 get their insurance through an employer. And if they lose their job and they have a pre-existing condition and they don't maintain continuous coverage, the next time they go to sign up for health insurance, that problem is not covered. So there's really no – I mean, which makes the whole point of having health insurance pointless. But under the new bill, you cannot be denied coverage because of pre-existing condition. And this is actually a hugely important thing in a lot of ways. It's hugely important for people who have pre-existing conditions, which means – for the population under 65, about one in three people have some kind of chronic illness.
Really?
Yeah.
So under 65?
Yeah, maybe if I can go into a little diversion here into some important numbers. What people don't realize is that most people actually need their health insurance. About a third of the population under 65 has some kind of chronic illness. And the biggest ones here are sort of the obvious ones. It's things like diabetes. About 8% of the American population has diabetes. It's asthma. About 5% of the American population has asthma. We could go on. And the numbers, of course, get smaller with each subsequent disease. But what it adds up to is a lot of people have chronic illnesses. And let's face it, the body is pretty complicated. Things go wrong. And so by age 65, a lot of people are sick. Also along the same lines, by age 65, one in six American males is dead, and most of them are dying from some kind of illness. It's not all car accidents and gunshot wounds. So they will have had some call on the healthcare system before they get to age 65. So health insurance is important because the risks are very high, and coverage for pre-existing conditions is important because so many people have pre-existing conditions. So what you don't want to have happen is something that I know about, which is young woman who goes off of her parents' policy. She's no longer a student anymore. She's employed in one of the usual low-end jobs that kids get when they're out of college, hoping to get into a quote-unquote real job, which means a job with health insurance, among other things, and is diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. And that was about 4 or 5 years ago. Well, she was uninsurable at age 26. with a chronic and crippling illness. So what could be done for her at that point? Nothing. No one was going to offer her insurance, and the change in the law now means she can find insurance and get treatment. Early intervention in this kind of a disease is important, and early intervention is important not just from a cost point of view, but also from the person's well-being, because this is an extremely painful condition as it gets worse. So that was a hugely important thing, getting the pre-existing conditions off the table. Also important are the health exchanges. They're not as robust as I would have liked, but they are a nose in the door in the following way, or a nose into the tent in the following way. By nose in the tent, I mean a way of holding down long-term costs by stripping out that administrative cost. The government is an extremely efficient provider of health care insurance. Medicare, for example, is extremely efficient. Its administrative costs are about 3%. Why is that? Well, it's very efficient because it's not busy checking every patient every time to assure that they still have their health insurance. It uses a standardized form. It has standardized categories. Everybody knows what the rules are. It's not denying coverage. It's not employing lots of clerks to move paper around to find ways to deny the claim, because the way health insurers make money is by denying claims and delaying claims.
And Medicare, Medicaid is not about that.
Medicare, Medicaid is not about that. Although Medicaid has more administrative. Medicaid is for people who fall into the bottom sixth by income. Medical insurance for poor people. There are qualifications, conditions. There's checking up. The administrative costs are higher. But Medicare, which is over 65s, over the elderly population, has very low administrative costs.
We're talking with Herman Schwartz of the University of Virginia. Well, yeah. Herman, what about the allegations that there's so much rampant waste and fraud that people get away with Medicare, and that people are terrified that the government would have more to do with healthcare in America. On top of that,
it would be hard to believe that the 20% of Medicare money is wasted. If we go back to that original point that $1,000 out of the $5,000 we're spending is on administration, it would be hard to believe that as much as 20% of Medicare dollars are wasted. Point two is that the current structure of the health insurance system and healthcare system, which is highly fragmented, which has not been subjected to information technology, actually makes it harder to root out waste and fraud. And the reason is there's no baseline. You don't know what the average is. You don't know what best practices are. And the provisions in the bill that were attacked because people thought they would lead to death panels, for example, or because they thought it would lead to government collecting information for comparative effectiveness research, these provisions were precisely about establishing a baseline. If you don't track people's health care, if you don't track what it costs to provide services across the entire country, you don't know what you're spending money on. So the more information we have, the better control you have over fraud, because you can say, hey, why is it that this healthcare practice in Tampa, which provides, let's say, CAT scans, is racking up four or five times as many CAT scans per patient as providers elsewhere in the country, right? Once you know what the average is in the country, you can identify the outliers. You can ask, what is it about the outliers on the high side that leads them to provide so much costly intervention? And then on the other side, what is it about these low-cost providers that allows them to be so efficient?
But conservatives fought that.
They fought that,
an effort to save money.
They fought that, yeah. But they fought that because the whole healthcare bill, from their point of view, is dangerous. And it's dangerous for the same reason that Social Security was dangerous in the 1930s, from their point of view. Once the government starts doing this, once people get used to it, once they discover that it's not the end of the world and the apocalypse, they come to love it. You don't see very many people agitating to get rid of Medicare. You do see people saying, get government off of my Medicare, which is kind of perplexing because it is a government
service. That was the funniest
thing
in the whole debate to me.
Yeah, but you don't see anybody running around saying, get rid of Medicare. And the reason is because
it works.
It guarantees people access to the healthcare system, and it guarantees what is an especially vulnerable population, access to the healthcare population. Again, just to put a number in people's heads, if you look at the average As I said, 8% of the American population diabetic. Well, 20% of the population over 65 is diabetic.
Wow.
These people have chronic illnesses, so they need some kind of care. And the question is, the moral question is, and also the political question is, can you deny care to these people? And the answer is probably not. And given that, then the question becomes, can you do this in the most cost-efficient and effective way? And the healthcare bill is designed to start moving things in the direction of a healthcare system that's more efficient and more rational, which is to say a system that pays people for preventing illness and for getting patients to be more compliant and for doing services that keep people healthy rather than paying people to do remediation, fix-up kinds of services. Doesn't do much good to give somebody a triple bypass operation at 65 for heart disease, if you could have spent a fraction of that money across their lifetime with patient education, maybe with some drugs, with some earlier intervention. Same thing with diabetes. Diabetics who manage their disease end up costing the system a lot less because the sequela, the outcomes of untreated diabetes are things like blindness, which is a very expensive condition to take care of. There are things like amputations, which people need home health care. These are all bad outcomes. It's much better to have people trained to take care of their diabetes and much better to have early intervention than let it go untreated.
We are talking with Herman Schwartz of the University of Virginia's Department of Politics. Now, let me ask you about the politics. Let's bring this down to the state level. Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli says, you know, he's suing the federal government and saying that you can't have that your national health care plan. We're not going to do that in Virginia. We talked to Joe Tye, the University of Oklahoma constitutional law professor, last week, who said that, you know, he doesn't have much of a legal leg to stand on, that it's going to be more about politics than the law. What's your take on the sort of the state level of this whole argument?
Yeah, I would concur with your con law professor. He's clearly more of an expert than I am, but my reading of the situation and of other analyses is that there's not much of a legal leg here for Ken Cuccinelli to stand on. At a local political level, I would guess that Ken Cuccinelli is trying to firm up a certain part of his voter base so that when time comes for him to seek another office, as he must in 3 years, he'll have some kind of electorate that he can turn to. So there's a very practical politics about this for him. But the obvious question here is, if the government is not constitutionally enabled to do this kind of intervention into the healthcare system, how is it that since 1965 it's been able to do Medicare? And the answer is, well, if nobody challenged Medicare, it's not because they were pretending to accept that it was constitutionally legal. Clearly, there must have been some basis to do this.
In the Commerce Clause, in the first place,
and also in the government's clear power to tax. And the current healthcare bill is structured as a taxation bill. And so it seems to me very unlikely that that there would be a constitutional challenge. Now, if the government said it was going to nationalize all existing healthcare services, there might be some basis for a constitutional challenge. But even there, I'm not so clear. It's not so clear. And the reason is the government already runs a lot of healthcare facilities. Those are the VA hospitals, for example. It's the entire military health complex that provides care to active duty service people and their families.
I mean, we have a huge part of our economy that's all about socialized medicine. We already have that.
Yes. I mean, again, not to put out numbers because they tend to go over right through people's heads in one ear and out the other. But private insurance is only 35% of current healthcare spending in America. All private insurance, if you count employers plus self-employed people, 42%. The vast majority of healthcare dollars in America are spent by the government. Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program, also vastly popular, is about 15%. Medicare is about 20%, and 12% is other sources of public money. So the government's already paying more than half of the healthcare dollars in the U.S. And again, we find this to be perfectly acceptable politically. So the question is, what does it mean if the government goes to 100% or goes to 80%? I'm not sure that's going to be politically unacceptable. The question is how it's done. So if your employer came to you today and said, okay, we're paying you $50,000 a year in your wage that you goes right into your pocket, but we're also spending $10,000 a year for health insurance. How about if we just convert that $10,000 into direct wages? And you can buy health insurance from anybody you want. And the government's out there offering $10,000 of health insurance, right? That's the scenario that the conservatives feared, because what would happen is the health insurance companies would rapidly be put out of business as people took that extra wage and spent it to buy health insurance on an out-of-pocket basis.
Conservatives want to make sure the money goes into the companies that they
conservatives wanted
represent.
It to be,
yeah.
Yes, going to the instead to the health insurance companies.
Herman
and
Schwartz,
also,
yeah.
Just as important, making sure the government didn't do it. Once the government gets control, the conservatives are right that once the government gets control of health insurance, it will never become private again. It'll be impossible to uncook that
egg. It's a good point, yeah.
Yeah.
Herman Schwartz, he's a professor of politics at the University of Virginia. His most recent book is Subprime Nation. We'll get you on again really soon. Thanks, Herman.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.